You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Well, last night, L.A. and Philly went down. Let's get an on-the-scenes report here. Nate with OccupyPhilly.org on the messaging and committee of correspondence for Occupy Philly. I love these phrases that come out of the revolutionary era. Nate, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I should add, I'm not physically there as we were completely evicted from the spot where the occupation was, and so our next official meeting we have planned is from contingency plans we made before really like 2 weeks ago at this point.
Right. So when are you announcing that? Where and when and all that kind of thing?
Today the original plan called for the day following eviction. We would have a meeting at 4 o'clock, and we would basically have a general assembly outside of the roundhouse, which is the building where the police take protesters who've been arrested for processing.
Okay, and I know, you know, this morning we have a number of people within the Occupy LA movement who have been on the program, and you know who've been staying there, basically, and none of them were available to us this morning. We literally could not get in touch with them. I'm assuming it's because they're all still in jail. There were 200 arrests there.
Right, that's what I heard as well.
Yeah, and so, you know, what we have are the reports from reporters that A, you know, L.A. and Philly went down or were taken down, and B, that unlike some of the previous, particularly Oakland's, and some of the previous events, that the police actually behaved in a fairly professional way. I mean, we're not happy about this being taken down, but they didn't come in, you know, pepper spraying people and beating them. Or is that not the case in Philly? Tell me what happened.
You know, in some ways the situation was better than in other places around the country. Certainly it was not like Oakland or
Denver.
In some ways about it wasn't Zuccotti when that was cleared as well.
Yeah.
I think we'll be still having meetings. It's going to actually make this movement stronger. It absolutely the people are still very much planning to work together, maintaining the importance of our direct democratic process going forward, and that's not going to change. That's for
right.
Sure.
Okay, so 4 o'clock today at the Roundhouse, you said?
Roundhouse, they call it. Yeah, it's at Ace and Race.
Okay.
Some people, I think, will be meeting at Rittenhouse at that time. But the original plan was to meet at Rittenhouse and then march over to the Roundhouse.
Okay, and that's for Occupy Philly, OccupyPhilly.org. Nate, thank you very much for the
website might be OccupyPhillyMedia.org. We've had all kinds of different ones.
Okay. All right.
And if folks are trying to get in touch with Occupy Philly or with any of our working groups, they can get in touch with the Committee of Correspondence, because we will help facilitate that and make sure you get in touch with the right person here.
Sounds like a plan. Nate, thanks a lot for dropping by and giving us the update.
No problem. Thank you.
Good talking with you this morning. And as I mentioned, L.A. went down last night, too, also apparently without, you know, enormous or horrific police violence, but went down. Meanwhile, Europe is, or at least the United Kingdom, not Europe, but the UK is shut down as we speak. I find this particularly interesting that you know, the austerity programs, it's like this worldwide thing that's happening all over the planet where basically the message is, you know, that middle class, it got too rich and too pesky. And so we're going to take it down a size. Because monarchy, rule by the 1%, is a much more stable form of government than democracy. And, you know, that middle class, it was just it was in the way of the oligarchies. Ellen Brown has an interesting piece over on Huffington Post today. And we had a long conversation with Ellen Brown a couple of days ago, or last week, week before last. And what she is pointing out is that back in the 70s, when central banks, when Europe's central banks could basically loan, create money and loan it to the government at no interest, then, you know, governments were in a position where they could deal with cyclical business crises and collapses and crashes and whatnot. And but now, because of the European Central Bank, individual countries can no longer borrow from their own central banks. They had to borrow from the European Central Bank, which is another private bank made up of banksters, just like the Fed is now a private bank made up of banksters. Well, has been all along. And but here, the Fed, when the Fed buys bonds, when the Fed loans money to the federal government, it has to do it in the open market. It has to do it through intermediary banks. It has to do it through Goldman Sachs or J.P. Morgan or, you know, like that. And they skim some off the top. They make their vig out of it. You know, the banks make a profit on that, a substantial profit. And the same thing in Europe. And the thing that I thought was most shocking that Ellen Brown pointed out was that the amount of debt in Europe and the amount of debt in the United States is roughly equal to the profit that the banks have made over the years on the government borrowing money from the Fed. Just ponder that for a minute. Meanwhile, Robert Reich talking about how 1914, Henry Ford jacked wages up to $5 a day. This was about three times what his workers were previously paid. The Wall Street Journal called it an economic crime. Horace Dodge was so horrified that he sued him, went to the state Supreme Court. But what it did was it allowed Ford's workers to start buying his cars. And that was the beginning, according to Robert Reich, our former labor secretary, that was the beginning of the modern day compact, which is that employees should earn enough that they can buy the goods of their employer. Employees should earn enough that they can actually make a decent living. And you may or may not recall that a couple of years ago there was a study, in fact, we did several programs about it, that showed that people who work at Walmart, if they bought 100% of the stuff that they need to live at Walmart, can't afford to live. They still need to go on public assistance and get things like food stamps and health care and whatever, because they can't afford to live. Our basic contract has broken down. And it's broken down since the beginning of the Reagan administration. This has been a 30-year, this is trickle-down economics, Reaganomics, supply-side economics. And it's happening all over the world in developed countries. That the 1% is getting fabulously rich and the 99% is getting screwed. And the governments that represent the 1% are saying, oh, and we need more austerity. This is the Republican mantra here in the United States. It's the conservative mantra in the United Kingdom. And in the UK right now, the people, the 99%, they're shutting the damn country down.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, if we move from pepper spray to tasers on Occupy Wall Street protesters. This is amazing stuff. This article, and a tip of the hat to in our chat room to Dinosaur, this story. I'll tell you more about it in just a second because we have a guest here I want to get right to. But a British company called Gamma International marketed hacking software to governments that exploited the vulnerability of Apple's iTunes so that they could spy on your computer if you had iTunes on it for 3 years. Anyhow, Mark Taylor Canfield from OccupySeattle.org is on the line with us. Mark, we just got an update from Nate in Occupy Philly. What's going on with Occupy Seattle?
Well, Occupy Seattle sent a lot of people to the state capitol on Monday. By the way, Tom, Dr. Cornel West told me to give a shout-out to you. He said he wanted to say hello to you.
Oh, great. Thank you. Give him my best. We spoke together at the Fighting Bob Fest in Madison a month or so ago. He's a great guy.
Yes, he thinks very highly of you as well. I just wanted to let everybody out there know that Occupy Seattle has still got an encampment of over 100 tents. We were invited by students to go to the Seattle Central Community College because there were so many arrests and so much police harassment down at Westlake Park in the middle of downtown.
Mm-hmm.
As of this Monday, the college president, Paul Kilpatrick, decided that he didn't really want us on the campus anymore, so they tried to pass an emergency rule prohibiting camping on the campus. The Occupy legal team actually filed for an injunction, so the college is due back in court on this Friday, so we have a little bit of breathing room, hopefully. Paul Kilpatrick is the college president, and he will be addressing our General Assembly tonight in Seattle at 7 o'clock at the college.
Wow.
So that'll be very interesting to see how that goes and see how accommodating he's going to become there.
Yeah.
In the meantime, we've had over 40 people arrested actually at the state capitol in Olympia because folks decided to get political and go down there and tell the state legislature and the governor that we don't want any more cuts to education, health care. We want a tax reform system. We want to stop one of the most regressive tax systems in the country here in Washington State. We have a 9.8% sales tax, and the governor would like to increase that, actually, to help pay for some of these deficits. Meanwhile, just like in the rest of the country, huge corporations and the wealthiest members of Washington State, the most wealthiest residents, are paying very few taxes,
right.
And we would like to see them close a few of those tax loopholes. It's been an uphill battle, I have to tell you, because the Washington State Patrol decided to start using tasers on people on Monday.
Oh, no.
And they keep saying that that they're not using tasers to disperse the crowd, you know, which sounds a little bit like Seattle when the police were using pepper spray to disperse crowds, like when they use it on Dorley Rainey.
Right.
But the evidence shows that there was an attempt, actually, to nonviolently sit down in the street and block a city bus that was commandeered by the police, actually. I remember seeing this here in Seattle during the WTO demonstrations where they get a county or city bus and they use it to fill up with prisoners and to transport them to the jails.
Mm-hmm.
So they were doing that on Monday in Olympia, and people decided to block the road as it was leaving the state capitol.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, they did taser people multiple times. They also tasered some people that were trying to get into the state capitol when we were having our sit-in. I actually was arrested inside the state capitol building with my press pass on, by the way, and I made it very clear that at that moment, I was there to cover it, and I had been reporting for several different news agencies. But, you know, they know that I've also been working with Occupy Seattle, and so I think they see me as one of the protesters. And
right.
What they did was they dragged me out of the Capitol Dome where we were holding our sit-in. And then instead of charging me with anything, they have given me what they call a no trespass order, which means that I'm not allowed on any of the state Capitol campus property, which includes all of the park around the lake in downtown Olympia, Capitol Lake, and the local city park, Sylvester Park, is all owned by the state. So at this point, I'm pretty much not allowed to go to any protest in Olympia, and I'm also not allowed to go to the Occupy Olympia encampment down there. But I've already went public and said that I'm going to challenge this, and I've got legal counsel, and we are going to challenge it because I do not believe that arresting somebody who is practicing nonviolent civil disobedience and then trying to bar them from future protests is constitutional. It's a direct violation of my freedom of speech and the freedom of the press because it will not allow me to cover any of these events if I can't be there.
Yeah.
So I am definitely going to challenge it.
Do you have the ACLU involved in this?
Excuse Excuse me?
Do you have the ACLU involved in this?
Yes, they are aware of what's going on.
Good.
But I'm going to personally challenge it, regardless of whether the ACLU steps up quickly, because I really feel like it is an act by the state, actually, to keep us away from the protests. There's no other reason for them to do it. I don't present any kind of a danger to anyone. I wasn't accused of any kind of violence or vandalism or property damage of any kind. And to bar me from public parks is totally ridiculous.
For the record, so you were not being violent and you were not resisting arrest.
No, I did not resist arrest. When the officer asked me if I was going to leave voluntarily, I said no. And I said, I'm here because of my freedom of speech and assembly. And he said, okay. And they just hauled me away. He asked me if I was going to leave. I actually said, no, sir.
But then when he arrested you, you didn't attempt to stop that. You just went along with being arrested. Yeah. Okay.
None of us did, actually.
So they don't have any charge against you for those. It's like they're trying to figure out how to walk this line, you know, and the Occupy movement is trying to figure out how to walk this line. And it's a very, very interesting dance that's evolving now. But you haven't actually been charged with anything, but you just have this essentially a restraining order.
Well, the issue is, number one, I refuse to sign any kind of a document without legal counsel under duress, okay?
Right.
And I told them that.
Right.
Number two, I am with the press, and I have been published nationally, so I will be back there. And this is not a court order. This is an order from the Washington State Patrol. So I have not been before a judge or a jury of my peers.
Okay, so I would say this is not legal. Mark Taylor Canfield, OccupySeattle.org, the website. Mark, thanks for the updates.
Hey, thank you, Tom.
Keep it going. Keep us up to date.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So to the larger issue, our economy is being brought down by the 1%. Students are massively in debt. What do we do after this? Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, it's time, the core causes of this stuff. I mean, why the Occupy movement? It's because the economy is melting down. And it's not just that the economy is melting down, it's that over the last 30 years, this failed experiment of Reaganomics has fundamentally changed the social contract of the United States. The social contract of the United States used to be, we invest in our people, we invest in our infrastructure. That's something government does. Companies are allowed to do business. And allowed is the right word. If you want to start a corporation, you have to go to a Secretary of State and register your articles of incorporation. And you have to play by the rules of the state and the federal government. Companies are allowed to do business in order to facilitate, not only their own commerce and profit, but the good of the country. And a tax code is in place that not only funds the government, but also establishes basically the rules of the game, much like the rules of baseball, the rules of football, are in place to make sure that the game can be played on an ongoing basis, season after season after season, without ever having one group or one team or one player end up completely dominating the whole thing. This is why the NFL, for example, the draft picks for the next year, the team that gets the first pick was the worst team from the previous year. There is fairness built into the system. That used to be our social contract. And Reaganomics blew up that social contract. George Herbert Walker Bush took it a step farther than that. Bill Clinton put it on steroids with free trade, although this certainly wasn't his idea. I mean, this goes back to arguably Richard Nixon, the first Republican to break with his party's orthodoxy that it was the anti-free trade party. And then George W. Bush just said, ah, to hell with it all. Let's borrow $5 trillion, fight some wars, put it all in the national credit card, have a good time. Make our banksters into billionaires. Dick Cheney's company, he made this horrible mistake when he was running Halliburton back in 1999 of buying Dresser Industries, which had this huge asbestos liability. They'd killed a bunch of people with mesothelioma, this horrible lung cancer. And Dick Cheney said, we'll buy them. We'll settle this stuff out of court. Well, not to, but the liabilities from Dresser nearly sank Halliburton. Halliburton almost out of business. When Dick Cheney leaves to go into the vice presidency, and now, of course, Halliburton, richer than the Koch brothers. Or maybe. So what we've seen is the basic social contract disintegrate, the rise of the elite. So let's get back to some of those fundamentals. And let's start with regard to those fundamentals. Let's start by saying it's time to occupy student loans and mortgages. The people on the bottom who are getting screwed, the people who should be the middle class in America, education should be free. It is in most developed countries, free or damn near free. So let's just say all student loan in the United States, which is, you know, somewhere between $800 billion and $1 trillion, which isn't all that much in the grand scheme of things, particularly when you consider that the Fed loaned out $13 trillion to wealthy individuals, large corporations like General Electric and banks, $7.7 trillion of it to the banks. A little less than $1 trillion is all the student loans. Let's just forgive them. That debt no longer exists. And then on the mortgage debt, let's create a system like Franklin Roosevelt did, where the government will become the lender rather than the banksters. Yes, there's profit to be made on mortgages. So let's ramp down the profit and take all the subprime loans and say, you know, you can sell your subprime loan to the government, to the federal government, and we will provide you with a fixed rate, low interest, 30-year loan backstopped by the government. See, your monthly payments are going to drop in half or thereabouts. And, yeah, I realize it's going to hurt the banksters. They're going to lose current and future profits. Screw them. They brought this crisis on us. It's time to have a jubilee, in essence. Let's forgive the student loan. Let's reorder. And it's not like we haven't done this before. But we've never done a forgiveness of student loan before, because in the entire history of our country, we've never had a student loan crisis like this. And this, again, goes back to Reagan as governor of California saying, well, free college? What? We can't have that. Those brats. Yeah, that was Reagan's term, brats. I mean, it wasn't this. I can't just blame everything on Ronald Reagan. Obviously, there's a whole school of thought here that embraces the idea of a royalty in the United States that needs to be confronted, needs to be outed. I wrote an entire book about this. Screwed: The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, tracking it all the way back to Thomas Hobbes. But most visibly, 1951, 1952, Russell Kirk and the modern conservative movement. William F. Buckley, Barry Goldwater, right up through the moment. Paul in Irvine. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, I just wanted to talk about
Hey, Paul, if you're on a speakerphone, can you take it off?
I'm on a cell phone. Can you hear me okay now?
Oh, yeah, okay. If that's all you got, sure.
Sorry, I just wanted to talk about KTLA, the reporter last night, David Begnaud. Reported on Occupy LA.
Right.
I just want to say shame on him. He kept mentioning, exaggerating the violence. In the 1 hour of time he had to report, he was talking about a guy who was holding a balloon full of vinegar to throw at the police. Shame on him, because he had hundreds of people he could have spoken to, and he chose to concentrate on that and keep the camera fixed on people with gas masks.
It's an example of if it bleeds, it leads journalism in the United States, which is, you know, one of the things that's wrong with our media. You're absolutely right, Paul. Thank you for sharing that and good point. From Paul to Paul in Venice. Hey, Paul.
Hey, Tom. Thank you. The Occupy people need to be occupying like the congressmen in Costa Mesa or the Republican Congress people and Senate people's places that are introducing these bills. They don't, you know, going downtown is just pissing everybody off. And they really need to be on the doorsteps of these people that are causing the problem. And one other thing I'll say is I have employees and they're all college educated, and I pay taxes so that I have those great employees. And that's what the Koch brothers have, and that's what the Walton family have. They want us to, they want everybody educated to a certain level to run their companies, but they don't want to pay for that education. They don't want to pay for the Coast Guard that guards their ships coming across the ocean.
Right.
And that's all I got to say.
Yeah, well, you said it very well. There is a reason for us to have a government. There is a reason for us to have free public education. And there are reasons for us to have this is basic infrastructure stuff. Mimi in Newport Beach. Hey, Mimi, what's up?
Mimi, hi, Tom.
You are on the air. Thank you.
Yes.
Hi, what's
okay.
up? What's on your mind?
I am calling about an article in the L.A. Times today written by Steve Lopez. Mm-hmm. Now, Steve is the man who did the stories on Nathaniel Hawthorne, the soloist that turned into a movie.
All right.
Hello?
Yeah. I said
oh,
okay.
I mean,
yeah, I'm listening.
Anyhow, his idea for Occupy L.A., which I thought was excellent, was to have the Occupy L.A.s get buses and bus the groups to different areas. He said he was talking about you can buy buses for $900 on the Internet, on eBay and stuff like that. But paint the buses really nice and then have a different, you know, because they're about so many different things, to, like, go to the governor's house when the governor has done something that, you know, they don't agree with, go to a congressman's house, only occupy for 3 or 4 days. And that way,
or even three,
you know,
or 4 hours.
All of your different, pardon?
Or even 3 or 4 hours. I mean, this evokes, the thing that this brought into my mind was two things immediately. First of all, you know, Stephen Gaskin and his bus ride that eventually became The Farm in Summertown, Tennessee, I think started in San Francisco, or Ken Kesey and his Merry Pranksters and their bus ride, or Sarah Palin. you know, with her
right.
bus,
and not
her
only
bus
that,
tour.
But you know, they could have their best speakers on the bus, the people that make the best impression, talk about the one subject at a time, have your other people back somewhere, get a building or something where you can be making signs so everybody has the same sign, and just pick a different thing. Can you imagine how much press coverage if the press doesn't know where they're going to be the next time?
Yeah.
I think that would be, you know, the press are going, well, where are they going to show up the next time?
Occupy some buses.
Subject. Pardon?
Yeah. Occupy some buses. And
right. Occupy buses, but have one different idea or subject in mind at the time. Pick someone who represents that problem and go and take your buses there for whatever length of time, but I'm sure they would get coverage.
Yeah.
Now they're at this place. Now they're at a senator's house.
Right.
And why are they at the senator's house?
Yeah. It's an interesting idea.
So anyhow, read the article. I think everyone should read that article and see. Just go under Steve Lopez, and the name of the article is Occupy L.A. on the Bus.
Okay.
And it just has really good ideas in it.
Okay. Mimi, thank you very much for the call. And let me just... We're out of time here, but let me just say, I think that this what has happened is that the snowball is going down the hill, and you know it's gonna move left to right, and it's gonna, you know, weave around some trees and things. And I'm mixing metaphors here with skiing, I suppose, but in any case, it's gonna get bigger and bigger and bigger. This is a genuine movement of people waking up. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Next up, lung cancer, what you don't know. And next hour, I'm asking, why do Republicans think sexual assaults are okay, but affairs are not?
Smoke, smoke, smoke that cigarette. Pop, 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 and if you smoke yourself to death.
Tell St. Peter at the Golden Gate that you hates to make him wait, but you just gotta have another cigarette.
Now, that's one of the stereotypes, and it's, well, of course, cigarettes do cause lung cancer, but there's much more to this. You know, we've all seen the runs for breast cancer, for example, and breast cancer awareness, this, that. Did you know that more women die from lung cancer than breast cancer? I mean, this is really startling stuff. Arielle Denson is with us. She's an advocate, daughter committed to advancing lung cancer awareness and support. LungCancerLeaders.org is the organization. Arielle, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Tom. I appreciate the opportunity. It's great to be with you.
Thank you for joining us and just, you know, helping inform our listeners and viewers to, you know, what's going on with this. A quarter of a million new lung cancer diagnoses this year?
Yep. 1 in 14 Americans are going to be diagnosed in their lifetime, which is a staggering number. You know, just by way of background, my mom was actually diagnosed stage 4 lung cancer in 2010. And, you know, like growing numbers of women diagnosed with lung cancer, she never smoked. You know, so once she was diagnosed, we really started to kind of conduct our own research, and we were blown away by the statistics.
Right.
Number one cancer killer among both, you know, men and women, as you suggested. And, you know, the survival rate has lingered around 15% for decades, and it's an underfunded, you know, overlooked, highly stigmatized disease. And, you know, the more we learned about it, we realized we needed to act.
Right. And in fact, I think most people think, oh, lung cancer must have been a smoker, should have known. Right. And in fact, that's occasionally the case, but that's not usually the case. And it's the most, you say it is the most, lung cancer is the most underfunded of the major cancers, receiving a small fraction of the dollars devoted to other diseases like breast or prostate cancer. And there's a lot of misinformation, misperception, and stereotyping attending lung cancer. So what do we do about this, Ariel?
So for the past year, my family's actually been working on a national advocacy campaign called Leaders of the Lung Cancer Free World. And it's really intended to kind of drag lung cancer out of the shadows and, you know, to generate greater public awareness and understanding of the disease. So as you mentioned before, we've got a website, lungcancerleaders.org, and there's so many ways that people can get involved if you join us on our website. There's actually a petition going encouraging the President and Congress to declare lung cancer a national health crisis. We've got three.
One in 14 people. That's, you know, if one in 14 people were going to be, you know, killed by terrorists, we'd be hysterical.
It's an unbelievable
number.
Right? I know, it's a bipartisan issue. It's affecting smokers and non-smokers alike. There's actually a really great piece of legislation, the Lung Cancer Mortality Reduction Act,
mm-hmm.
Which actually aims to reduce lung cancer mortality in half by 2020.
Okay.
And it has just lingered in the House and the Senate. So we'd like to draw attention to that as well. We've also got a function where you can pledge to stop smoking, or encourage a loved one to do so as well. And you join our online community. We've actually been really overwhelmed by the response, you know, on Facebook and Twitter, just stories pouring in. There's clearly a need, you know, for this type of support.
That's great. That is absolutely great. Ariel, thank you so much for coming on and sharing with us what you're doing and how it's working, and that people can go to lungcancerleaders.org for more information. I salute you.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much, Tom. And thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much, Ariel, for dropping by. Great talking with you. And now, Alan in Thousand Oaks. Alan, it says you disagree with me, so you go to the front of the telephone line. What's up?
Well, first of all, I want to make sure we're talking about higher education, secondary education.
Yes.
Not elementary education.
Yes, I'm talking about college. I think college should be free because it is an investment by our society in the intellectual infrastructure and thus the future of our nation. That's why it's free in most every developed country in the world, free or close to free.
Okay, that's what I want to disagree with you about. In these countries that you're talking about with free public education.
Right, like Germany, France, Japan.
It's strictly rationed by very difficult entrance exams. And not only does that, these exams create terrible anxiety for people, but a lot of people don't get in, which is why so many foreign students come to U.S. universities.
Well, yes, no, and maybe. I could tell you from having lived in Germany and having had a kid who was of high school age at that time, and when they were preparing for those exams, that what they have in many European countries is very, very good non-college trade programs. So if you can't, you know, if you're academically not capable of attending college, then that's fine. There is a program that you can go through that will train you for to become a skilled tradesperson that also will give you a good solid middle class income.
United States has gone the other direction, Tom. Our philosophy is to make higher education available to everybody, which is why we have community colleges that have no entrance requirements at all.
Higher education is available to everybody everywhere in the world, Alan. People are not coming to the United States because there's a shortage of colleges in Germany. If you want to get into the better schools, if you want to get into and if you want to get in for free, yes, you have to demonstrate that academically you can perform. But if you decide that you want to go to college, there are private colleges in these other countries.
But they're very expensive.
Some of them are not. You have an open market in education.
Public education in the United States is universal. That's why we have community colleges, so that anybody...
Community colleges are subsidized education. So you're making my argument.
No, I'm not.
Community colleges, when you go to a community college, what you are paying is a fraction of the actual cost.
I understand. That's the problem, Tom. You're not listening to me. The problem is that in order to provide universal education, it's very expensive. The government has to pay a lot of money for it. In these other countries that you're talking about that have free education for those that pass the entrance exams, the costs are less to government.
From the time when Abraham Lincoln created free land-grant colleges all over the United States, from the time that Abraham Lincoln created free land-grant colleges, universities around the United States, until the 1980s when college tuitions started going up substantially, we were not, you know, we had, you know, the structure of our college system has not changed that much, and people could graduate from college without massive debt. I'm telling you, Alan, you got to you need to talk to somebody who's over 50 and ask them how it was, because you don't get it. Anyhow, we'll continue. Eric Beiler is going to drop by about Occupy LA. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So what happened in Los Angeles last night? Clark Davis with OccupyLA.org on the line with us. He's the media liaison for Occupy LA. The OccupyLA.org website, by the way, one of the cool things down toward the bottom. There's a new app, I'm Getting Arrested, that you could use. Clark, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Tom.
So I understand Villaraigosa said that he's breaking up Occupy LA because he's concerned about the children, although there are 13,500 homeless students in Los Angeles, children in Los Angeles. And so anyhow, that seems a little weird. But what happened last night?
Well, if Occupy Los Angeles is anything, it's peaceful and nonviolent. There was not a single incident of violence at all last night, not one. And I confirmed that with Commander Smith of the LAPD, who I had been working relatively close with over the last few days. Mm-hmm. It was an absolutely incredible evening in every single way, shape, and form, almost unimaginable and poetic in a strange way. But like I said, started at around 11 o'clock or so. It was an 8 or 9 hour incident. 1,400 police officers, 200 and some odd arrestees. It seemed like absolute chaos in a certain sense. Mm-hmm. But like I said, there was not a single incident of violence at all.
So the police were behaving, I mean, nobody's happy that Occupy LA got taken down, but the police were behaving in a professional and rational fashion. And
the LAPD stepped up and behaved like human beings.
Like peace officers.
Yes.
As opposed to riot cops. And mm-hmm. and the occupiers also behaved like people who are exercising their constitutional right to dissent, to speak out, to protest, but haven't gone beyond that to the non-constitutional right to, for example, riot.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. That's I suppose good news. Where does Occupy LA go from here now?
Well, therein lies the big question. I mean, I think we all need to really look within here. I think we had some amazing opportunities over the last 60 days to really make a difference in the discussion that the country is having right now. I think the environment that we experienced there was very challenging. You're talking about homeless children. We were in the heart of the homeless capital of America. Mm-hmm. And it proved to be incredibly challenging to really get down to business over there because the environment was so incredibly challenging.
With gangs and everything else.
Yeah, I mean, we rapidly, were forced to become a kind of social workers and peace officers in our own right, just to try to handle, you know, the element that kind of overtook our camp, to be quite honest with you. We weren't necessarily prepared for it and didn't do a very good job addressing it.
Yeah.
Of course, now, you know, that's one of the reasons why we're there is because of homelessness.
Sure, sure. And yet at the same time, when, you know, one of the strategies is to dump more homeless people on your doorstep, you know, that you know, throws it all out of proportion to the ratio in society. And suddenly, like you said, you're docs and social workers, and that's not the role of Occupy LA. Somebody called into the program in the last hour. We had a fairly long conversation about this, and we had Nate on from the Committee for Correspondence and the messaging guy for Occupy Philly, and Mark Taylor Canfield called in from Occupy Seattle. We're getting all these Occupies all around. But we had a caller who called and said that there's apparently an op-ed in the LA Times or one of the newspapers suggesting, how about Occupy the Buses? Take a tip from Sarah Palin, and although I don't think the article said that, that's what came to my mind. Or maybe a tip from Ken Kesey and Steve Gaskin, for those people old enough to remember who those folks are, and get some buses, and, you know, whenever a member of Congress is doing something outrageous, you know, occupy the street in front of their office for a few hours, or when something's going. In other words, start you know, strategically occupying places, but still being very visible and paint and using the sides of buses as signs, which is certainly legal in our society. The city buses sell those signs. So, yeah. Thoughts?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I was just ruminating, you know. I'm not proposing that.
I think there's any number of fantastic ideas that we could start utilizing to further this movement and help it grow.
Yeah.
You know, one of the biggest problems, I believe, at this point in time is if you ask, you know, 500 different occupiers why they're there, what the problems that this nation and the planet faces, and what the solutions to those problems are, you're going to get 500 different answers.
Yeah.
And I really...
Although I'm guessing there are some substantial threads that run through all of them, which have to do with the 1% basically squeezing the blood out of the 99% over the last 30 years with Reaganomics and Clintonomics.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I think, though, we really need to find some concepts that we can latch onto as a movement that allows Americans to really just kind of fall in place, that we become undeniable. And I think that's possible, but I do think it would take a pretty concerted effort amongst, you know, the Occupy groups spread across the country to unify. Right. We're making attempts to do that. It's still obviously a young movement, and hopefully we'll see some of that in the near future.
Yeah, and it will evolve and grow. Clark, thank you for the update and for filling us in on what's going on. People can learn more about it over at OccupyLA.org. Clark Davis.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you, Clark. Good having you on. I do appreciate it. 866-97-THOM, our telephone number. Roger in L.A. Hey, Roger, in the last hour we were talking, I was saying that we need to occupy our schools. We need to forgive all student loans. Student loans should be education in the United States, period, should be free. And we need to occupy our mortgages. We need a jubilee. We need to do like Franklin Roosevelt did and refi people's homes, have the government do it at fixed rates, at low rates, at low interest rates, and not make the profit that the banksters make, and just get the banksters out of both of these businesses. Roger, you wanted to call on that topic.
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air, Roger.
Yeah, Tom, just before the break, you had a caller about foreign students coming here.
Yeah, he said that because other countries have free education, you know, France, Germany, you know, what you fill in the blanks, because they have free college education, it's hard to get into their schools because they have to ration it, and therefore we've got all the bad students from the rest of the world coming here to the United States. I don't accept that premise. I'm assuming that's what you wanted to speak to.
That is a problem. Yeah, that's what I want to respond, because I came here as a foreign student.
Mm-hmm.
I came from India.
Okay.
Okay. That's all bogus. See, actually, you get free education in India. The best university I went to, IIT Bombay, and I was paying $1 per month was my fee.
$1 per month for college education in India.
Yeah, I mean, this is because it's It's all like here, what you call public college.
Yeah.
It's a public university.
Yeah.
There are a few private universities, maybe. They may cost more. But then you don't need to go, unless rich people go there. You don't have to go there. You can get the best education.
So we have just a minute left, Roger. Why come to the United States?
Oh, the only reason we come here is the advanced education. Like people not only come to America, they go to England, they go to Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the higher advance, you know, and also it carries...
For postgraduate you know, like studies you're talking about.
But engineering, science.
Yeah, postgraduate stuff.
Huh?
So postgraduate what education or specialty education, is that what you're talking about?
Engineering, postgraduate, like master's and PhDs.
Right.
Not bachelor's.
Okay, right. I get it. Great. Roger, thank you very much for the call. And, it's interesting. You know, how do we organize a free educational system or one like in India where you can get your bachelor's degree for $1 a year, anybody in the country? How do we organize that here in the United States?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I think we start by waking people up to the fact that we're being screwed consistently, steadily, by the conservatives and Republicans. Taking back to mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. Anthony is an Occupy camper at Occupy Los Angeles, been occupying since day one. Anthony, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So what we heard from another occupier just a few minutes ago. What was your experience of what happened in Los Angeles last night, Occupy LA last night?
No, my experience is that we're living in Cuba. We live in a police state. I couldn't believe the things I saw out there.
Okay.
It was amazing. First of all, the amount of money that it took to occupy people who were just going to come back the next day and do the same thing was an insult to the taxpayers. I mean, there was so much money being out there last night.
You're talking about all the police who were drawing overtime
all
the equipment.
I mean, there are countries that don't have that kind of police force. I mean, you know, the military that big.
Yeah.
But on top of that, after we were out, my girlfriend was in there, got arrested. I'm going to go visit her in the Van Nuys jail today. But after we got out, we were on the street, peacefully just standing there watching, and we ended up marching through the streets with the police chasing us, and we got trapped into a little corner, and people got beaten by the police. And they were very careful to wait until there was a place where there wasn't a lot of media and there weren't a lot of people taking photos. But
now, that's a very different story from what we've heard from other people who were suggesting that the takedown last night of the Occupy place that you're not describing
talking about the actual takeout.
Okay.
I saw some violence there too, and we have videos of it. I encourage anyone who wants to go against the propaganda that's being spread that it was nonviolent on the part of the police, just go to YouTube and press police violence, police brutality, Los Angeles, the night of the day. In there, it wasn't so bad. It was mostly just people being manhandled, shoved to the ground, that kind of thing. But on the streets, people actually got beaten. And the group of us, there was, I don't know, 100, 200 of us running through the streets and getting sort of fed down alleys here and there through Japantown.
Interesting. Well, Anthony, thank you for sharing your story with us.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious, before you go, what did you do that would provoke the police to chase you? I mean, for example, we've seen video in Oakland of people smashing windows. It doesn't seem inappropriate for police to chase people smashing windows. Were you just walking down the street? Or?
Yeah, it was nothing. I mean, that's a big story that's running around the country, that if the police do this, they must be provoked.
Right.
Absolutely not. There are just people there who've been itching for this. Mm. And, first of all, they come up with laws like unlawful assembly all of a sudden that get arbitrarily applied.
Right.
When there are larger groups gathering on the street all over the place in L.A. for other causes. But we got charged with unlawful assembly for being in the street there.
Right. Okay.
And, you know, that was ostensibly, you know, their rule. We're going to arrest you right now. And we said, no, you're not going to arrest us. And then
we
moved away, and they chased us, and we kept moving, and they kept chasing us.
So, Anthony, what's next for you in the movement?
What's next is today we're going to all gather together again and march right back.
Okay.
And we're going to keep doing our GAs, mm-hmm. our General Assemblies at City Hall, because it's a public common space for all citizens.
Yep.
And then we're going to keep spreading the movement, keep spreading the ideas, start occupations further and wider. We have a West Coast port shutdown coming up all across the West Coast. We have occupations of foreclosed homes and of banks coming up. So
mm-hmm.
I think it's all about more and more actions.
Yeah.
Until they simply can't ignore how many American citizens are fed up.
Yeah, and not
money.
Just fed up and damaged, fed up and hurt, fed up and unemployed,
oh, yeah.
fed up and broke.
That's why you have families with kids at the occupation. You know, it's no longer a scene for young kids who want something to do. You know, it's damaged. You're right, as you say, damaged, hurt people who have nothing left to lose, have nothing to turn to.
Yeah, when you got nothing to lose. We're calling for a jubilee here on this program for forgiving all student debt and all mortgage debt in the United States, period. Just wipe it all off, screw the banksters,
right,
let them go down, and, you know, which is, you know, it's biblical, actually, the concept of jubilee.
Yeah.
Every 50 years, all debt, all wealth would be equalized. I'm not going quite that far, although I'm not sure that wouldn't be a really good idea.
It would be a great idea. It was great when Bono and all his friends had that campaign at the turn of the century, right, for country debt, which also
yeah.
if we forgave all the country debt, that also would solve
yeah.
the problem.
Although Bono didn't let go of his own debt. Or his own wealth, rather. I mean, you know,
well,
so
thanks
you know.
For quoting Dylan on your program. That makes me trust you.
Okay, all righty. Anthony, thanks a lot for the call. And keep up the good work. I wish you the very best. It's great to hear from you. Craig, hang on just a second. It says you disagree with me here, and I just got a 1 minute cue from Jacob, and I, you know, if you want to debate me, I don't want to be cutting you off. Cheyenne in Long Beach, is it quick? We have a minute.
Oh yeah, so you rather cut me off?
Well, it looked to me like from your topic that it was just a quick one. So if you want, I'll put you on hold and come back to you because I.
No. It's going to be really quick. First of all, I don't understand where they get all this money to suddenly put all these officers around the cities in America to crack down on the poor and disenfranchised.
Right.
And they were just crying broke. I don't understand where they got all the money from all of a sudden to pay all of these officers for all this overtime. That's one thing. Another thing, maybe they should try occupying K Street.
Yeah.
Occupy
well, they have.
Restaurants.
They have,
well,
actually.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Occupy these restaurants where these politicians go in these restaurants with the lobbyists and have a fabulous meal. Make it uncomfortable to where they like to go and do these deals.
Yeah. I think this is starting to happen, Cheyenne. I think this is really starting to happen, and we're seeing this, you know, people, I mean, even President Obama got mic checked the other day. People are starting to show up, and it'd be very interesting to see, you know, the next time Paul Ryan's sitting around with $600 worth of wine on the table, somebody occupy the table next to him. Cheyenne, thanks a lot for the call.
You're right listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
27 minutes past the hour. How does a jubilee work? I'll tell you right after this.
It'll come true.
Four minutes past the hour. Welcome back to your media support group for We the People of the United States. Well, of the planet Earth. I mean, we really need to be thinking of ourselves in those terms. We the people of planet Earth. So Jubilee was this idea that if you go back in the Bible, I believe this is in Genesis. It's been a long time since I read the Bible four times, but it's been several decades. But I remember this very vividly, that every seventh year, you had to leave the fields fallow. In other words, give the soil a chance to regenerate. And that every seventh cycle, every 49 years, on the year following the 49th year, every 50 years, that you rebooted basically everything. Everybody put what they owned into the pot. All the slaves were freed, and the rich were no longer rich, the poor were no longer poor, and the pot got redistributed. Not that pot. Hey, by the way, speaking of that pot, did you see this thing where the states that legalized marijuana have a 9% decrease in highway fatalities? Because people are smoking pot instead of drinking alcohol? So you don't have drunk drivers? Anyhow, a digression, but one that I thought was fairly important. In any case, so every 50 years, what they would do is basically equalize all the debt. And in the next hour, Steve Keen is going to be on, and we're going to be talking about the cycles, economic cycles that happen. But the idea of a jubilee breaks those cycles. And it prevents multi-generational dynastic wealth from accumulating. And I think it's a great idea. And a fellow by the name of Herman, I'm forgetting his last name, and this is like 20 years ago. He used to be one of the senior officers in the World Bank, and he wrote a book about the Jubilee that I read long ago and far away, in which he was proposing this. You know, it was a serious proposal. I mean, there's been a number of serious economic thinkers who have proposed this, and we're going to get into that in more detail in the next hour. 866-987-THOM. Okay, Craig in San Jose, it says here you want to disagree with me, so as I said, you go to the front of the line, and this time we're not going to be cut off in 45 seconds. What's up?
I really appreciate it. A friendly correction, and please correct me if I misheard you last week, but you had a caller last week calling in on Citizens United, and I believe they were proposing that the major funders of political ads have their identities disclosed in the ad, and I believe your comment was that your understanding was that Citizens United had made that unconstitutional, and that's incorrect.
If I said that, I misspoke. It would be aconstitutional, not unconstitutional. It's irrelevant to the Constitution.
Just to clarify then, 8 of the 9 justices in that Citizens United case mentioned that in their different opinions that disclosure was both necessary and important for voters to have. And so in California Clean Money Campaign, an organization I've been working with for 7 years, I have a bill in the California Assembly called the California Disclose Act, mm-hmm. which will do that very thing. And, of course, if California passes it, then the rest of the country will pay attention, and it'll also help to reinvigorate the federal effort to do the same thing. You may know Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats in the House passed the Federal Disclose Act a year ago summer, but it was killed in the Senate by the Republicans. So we really need your help to help us publicize the California Disclose Act.
Okay. Well, you just did that, and good on you for it. Is there a website?
Yes, CACLEAN.org.
CLEAN, clean?
No. Yeah, CA for California, clean, CLEAN, .org.
Okay, great. Now, as to the 8 of the 9 justices talking about disclosure, yeah, and talk is cheap. The fact of the matter is that in part as a result of Citizens United, you can now do like Stephen Colbert is doing tongue-in-cheek, you can raise unlimited amounts of money from people whose identities are never revealed, and you can spend that over the name of any name that you want. So you can create an organization called Citizens for Better Government or something and run ads that trash a particular politician, and people will never know that it's actually, you know, Charles Koch.
Exactly, and that's exactly what the California Disclose Act will fix. You'll no longer be able to get away with, you know, things like you just said. You know,
at least in the state of California.
It drills down. You have to identify the major funders of the ad.
Now, Craig, have you I'm assuming you have. Have you tested this? I mean, is this something that Citizens United or the Supreme Court or one of the other decisions actually? You know, the Citizens United just was the last in a long series. The two big ones before right. that were Buckley versus Vallejo and First National Bank versus Bilotti.
But
does your clean, your Disclosure Act, caclean.org, does this, would it pass Supreme Court muster in these days of judicial review and judicial supremacy?
Exactly. All the attorneys that we've consulted, believe that we can. It hasn't been tested, of course, at the Supreme Court level, although,
right.
as I mentioned, in the Citizens United opinions, there were, of course, concurring opinions and dissenting opinions.
Yes.
They mentioned that although you couldn't restrict corporate spending, which was the thrust of the decision, that things like disclosure were okay.
And so
while the court didn't specifically rule on that issue, the statements that 8 of the 9 justices made in their various opinions, give strong suggestion that they don't have a problem with that.
Right. So if you can't get the money out, at least find out where the hell the money's coming from.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What Citizens United, as you know, it said that you can spend all the money you want and we can't stop you, but you can also do it anonymously. We're probably going to have a constitutional amendment to fix the first part, and that'll take a little while. But in the meantime, we can at least bring transparency to the whole process by requiring that they no longer can do it anonymously.
Okay. Craig, thank you very much for the call, and good luck on your adventure there, and I wish you well. And darn, I thought I was going to argue with somebody. Ronnie in Orlando. Hey, Ronnie, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I appreciate your show. And
thank you.
I have a quick comment about the Jubilee year idea. There's a fellow named David Graeber, an anthropologist from University of London, has a book out, Debt, the First 5,000 Years.
Yes.
And, it's very interesting. We need to realize that debt is a socially constructed object. Okay,
yes.
Just like money. Money.
Yes.
It's entirely socially constructed.
Right.
And debt is, he actually traces it to a moral idea that, we have to fulfill our obligations. Once we see, however, that what we're thinking of as debt really is no longer playing a moral role in our society, we need to cancel it.
And
Graeber is also calling for a Jubilee year.
Yeah, I know. In fact, if you go to conversationswithgreatminds.com, you will see a half-hour conversation that I had with David Graeber about a month ago.
Oh, fantastic.
He happened to be here in Washington, D.C., and we grabbed him and got him in the studio in front of a TV camera, and I talked with him for a half hour, and it's up there. But
I will check that. But the thing I called about, Tom, let me quickly get this out. I haven't heard you talk about this. Maybe you did. The National Defense Authorization Act.
Yes, we talked about that yesterday. We had a fellow from the DC ACLU on the program, pointing out that the Carl Levin and John McCain's Defense Authorization Act, which was unanimously passed out of the Defense Committee, would basically turn the entire world, including your backyard, into a worldwide battlefield against al-Qaeda that will last forever. We are now in the era, if this thing passes, of perpetual war for perpetual peace, George Orwell.
It does not specifically name al-Qaeda.
It actually does. I read the bill last night.
We could become...
No, wait a second, Ronnie. Ronnie, I actually read the bill last night. And it does quote al-Qaeda.
In fact, I'm just reading the part that's on the ACLU website of what these sections.
Yeah, read the entire bill because, as I said, I did.
Indefinitely imprisoned without charge or trial, American citizens.
Yes, because I called Carl Levin's office last night and I said, to the press person there, Carl Levin used to be my senator when I lived in Michigan, and Carl Levin's a good guy, why would he do this? And they referred me to a bunch of things, including the bill itself. And in the bill, it says only if you're al-Qaeda. However, who gets to decide that, right? It's the administration. What criteria do they use to decide that you're al-Qaeda? They're not saying. So basically what this is giving the president, you have to be al-Qaeda and you have to be actively engaged in either planning or executing a terrorist attack against the United States in order to fall under the provisions of this bill.
Broadened to fit all kinds of things.
Right. So, well, that's,
I mean,
and that's the problem.
McCain.
Go ahead.
My husband, who's from Amsterdam, points out that, you know, Hitler came to power legally.
Yeah, well, arguably. Yeah, arguably, you're absolutely right. And this is why this needs to be stopped. Thank you, Ronnie, for the call. Call your senators and say no to the Defense Authorization Act, period.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, Tuesday News and Alert, and Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service will be checking in with us. Stick around. Okay, our cheesy news alert, courtesy of Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com. Of course, this is news with tongue-in-cheek. Herman Cain has not withdrawn, but Herman Cain withdrew from the Republican presidential race today, a move that resulted in millions of pro-adultery voters shifting their support to former House Speaker Newt Gingrich. The shift in support is significant because pro-adultery voters represent the single largest voting bloc in the Republican Party, experts say. Tracy Kloogian, a prominent adulterer from Concord, New Hampshire, said he was sorry to see Mr. Cain leave the race, quote, because he was very committed to the one issue I care about, namely adultery, end quote. But he added that he had been in touch with many other adulterers in the state and that they were all switching to Mr. Gingrich. He said, even when we were supporting Cain, a lot of us were supporting Gingrich behind his back. The adulterer said, I guess that's how we do what we do. There you go. So, Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by Self-Empowerment, 9 Things the 19th Century Can Teach Us About Living in the 21st, by Ellen Ratner and Ann Gaiman. And Victoria, Herman Cain has not dropped out of the race yet, right?
Breaking what Herman Cain said today at the Dayton Marriott in Ohio. Now, I'm reading this directly from the New York Times, so I think this is not a typo.
Okay.
They want you to believe that with enough character assignation on me, I will drop out. The American people have a different idea. The American people are going to raise some Cain in 2012.
Oh, that's interesting. Assignation as opposed to assassination.
That's what it says in the New York Times.
Well, people are assigning character to him, I guess.
They're certainly
what kind of character,
some character,
I don't know. But...
to him.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, so what else is going on in the world? You're in the White House right now, right?
I'm in the White House right now. The president is not. He's in Scranton, Pennsylvania, where he is scrambling in Scranton. He was going to be speaking about jobs, the payroll tax cut, and trying to convince voters in Hillary country that he is their man. In a state where really he's got less than 50% support right now, and the state that he won handily in 2008.
Wait until he unleashes Joe Biden in that state. I was in a dinner with Joe Biden a couple of weeks ago, and you know, he came out and he walked the room. I mean, he worked the room. He walked around and put his hand on people's shoulders and things. I mean, he's just, Joe Biden is one of the best retail politicians I've ever seen, and he's beloved in Pennsylvania.
He is. He is a piece of work.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I mean, I'm not, this is not a statement about his policies or anything other than that. It just blew my mind to see a world-class politician, you know, 10 feet away from me, just blowing out it was just incredible. Anyway, back to you.
And that is exactly what the Obama campaign actually plans to do. They intend to unleash him.
Yeah, good.
And let him go.
Good.
Let's cross the pond to the United Kingdom.
Yeah, I would love to get your take on this. The UK is shut down right now. People are protesting austerity.
Yes.
Tell me about it.
2 million public sector people have walked out, strikes over public sector pensions. Basically, as an example, teachers have walked out. 19,000 out of 21,700 schools in England and Wales are closed or partially closed.
Wow. Now, by pensions, what we're talking, here in the United States, we would call that Social Security.
Right. I mean, basically, for example, with a teacher, at the moment they retire at 60. The government now says they have to retire at 68.
Yikes.
And wants them to pay 50% more towards their pension.
Yikes.
Correct.
So they're doubling the Social Security tax, and then they're making them retire 8 years later. And oh man.
Right. So it's pretty draconian. It really is pretty draconian.
Yeah.
And there's a fascinating number of people who, and types of people who are striking, people who've never struck before, outside the Crown Prosecution Service in Manchester. Right, we're talking about prosecutor's office. A handful of lawyers were among those manning the picket line.
Remarkable.
And apparently, according to one person who represents justice and prosecution sectors of the PCS, we've had a lot of support from judges who are, of course, also public sector workers. We're talking about border agency staff, probation officers, radiographers, librarians, court staff, social workers, refuse collectors, midwives, cleaners, school meal staff, paramedics, tax inspectors, customs officers, police civilian staff, driving test examiners, patent officers, and health and safety inspectors. 6,000 out of 30,000 non-urgent hospital operations, that surgery to us, were canceled today.
Wow.
And interestingly, many of these people are first-time strikers. These are not sort of radical unionists, the kind that you hear about in lefty Europe.
These are the leftover miners that Margaret Thatcher threw out of business.
No, they're not. And many of them are women, the sort of the last to strike.
So the question then, I mean, you know, when David Cameron and his Conservative Party came into power in this coalition with Nick Clegg and the Liberal Dems, his whole shtick was, we're going to impose austerity, we're going to cut the budgets, which is basically what the Republicans are saying we have to do here in the United States, and they're doing it in many of the states, and that's going to make everything wonderful. And in fact, what it did is it contracted the British economy by 0.5%, it increased unemployment, and the austerity itself is what you're talking about, you know, work longer, get less, and all that kind of thing. What is this, in the minute we have left, Victoria, what will this mean for the future of the Conservative Party and David Cameron, and for that matter, to the Lib Dems who are kind of going along with it?
Well, because of the slowdown in the Eurozone, British economic growth this year and next is going to be slower than forecast. In fact, the austerity is going to go beyond the elections in 2015. I think this is going to be bad for the Conservatives in the next election.
And what about the Liberal Dems who are working with them in coalition?
I think if they're smart, they'll start to get critical, and they could maybe start to form an alliance with Labour. Otherwise, I think Labour could clean up.
Yeah. It seems that the Lib Dems right now should break out of the coalition and force a crisis.
They would be smart to do so, I think.
Yeah, interesting. But they probably won't, right?
No.
Yeah, okay. you and I keep coming to this about this politician or that. Yeah, they would be smart to do that, but they won't. Well, okay. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Brought to you by Self Empowerment, the book by Ellen Ratner. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Great having you on.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And a special treat today. We're going to have Louise, thank you. We're going to have, we have with us Professor Steve Keen. He's the Associate Professor of Economics and Finance at the University of Western Sydney, the author of Debunking Economics. And his website, which is a must-read, debtdeflation.com. Check that out. Professor Keen from Australia, thank you for joining us. Welcome.
You're welcome, Tom.
We had an interesting conversation a couple of days ago on television, and I want to revisit some of those topics here in a little longer form. We're gonna take this entire hour. There will be periodic commercial breaks and things, but or breaks, as it were, but. Let's start at where we are right now. Are we in a depression?
Yes. It's amazing how long people will spend in denial about virtually any problem, from personal health through to economic crises, but this one is a depression. It is not a recession. And the sooner we make that categorization of the situation we're in, the sooner we'll start getting potentially sensible policies rather than the insane ones that are being debated right now.
Now, the last Great Depression, the one in the 1930s, was not identified as a depression for some time. About what point in time did people start referring to it as a depression and realizing the level of reaction that was necessary to it?
Yeah, it was in fact called the Depression because all downturns were called depressions back then. It's interesting how one of the major things humans do is come up with softer sounding alternatives to harsh words we use initially.
Right.
So a boom was called a boom, and a recession was called a depression back then. It became called the Great Depression towards about 35, 36, that period. And certainly, if you look through Keynes's general theory, for example, there's no reference to a Great Depression. So only
right.
probably once the Second World War had started did the word start coming into Great Depression come into usage to distinguish from all previous depressions, which were nowhere near as severe as that one.
Right. So realizing that this was a unique event, or at least a unique event in the lifetime of the people who were alive at that time. That was only in retrospect. Do you think that this Great Depression that we're in right now, and would you call this a Great Depression, will be recognized in retrospect, or do we have the ability to recognize it for what it is right now? And what's the criteria that you would use to say, yes, this is a depression?
Well, firstly, we do have the capacity to classify it properly, but that's a capacity which only a handful of people who actually have any understanding of what caused the crisis actually have. I'm one of them, but I'm not the only one. People like Michael Hudson, for example, and Peter Fors and so on are others who identified this as not your ordinary recession. Something, therefore, has to be classified differently. Closest thing to it is the Great Depression, though just recently Ken Rogoff, who's one of the empirically oriented neoclassically originated economists I have some time and respect for, he's come out and said, we stop calling it the Great Recession, call it the Great Contraction. And that, in that sense, gives you anything we'd call both the Great Depression and this experience a Great Contraction. And what helps you identify it in a causal sense is that what causes a crisis like this is a sustained reduction in the level of private debt after that private debt has reached unsustainable levels previously. So the Great Depression, just to give you an idea of that, had a level of private debt that peaked at 235% of GDP, but that was after 2 years of deflation after the start of the crisis. It began at a level of 175% of GDP. Once the whole thing was over, and by over I mean the end of the Second World War, because the Great Depression led to the Second World War, the debt level was back down to 45%. So you go from 175% of GDP to 45% of GDP, and then the whole thing started all over again. We have gone from 45%
if I may interrupt
to 300%. Yeah.
Before you continue with the story, you said then the whole thing started all over again. Did it start all over again in the 1940s? Or you mean it started all over again in the 1980s or 90s or the
2000s? In one sense, if I wanted to say when we actually got into the speculative bubble stage that led to the crisis we're now in, I'd date that from the 60s. You're quite right.
Okay.
But after the 1930s experience, the debt level was paid down so far that we probably got below what you might regard as a sustainable and sensible level of debt for the American economy when you hit 45% of GDP.
Right. So we hit 45%. To current day, this is where you were going when I interrupted you. My apologies.
Yeah, no worries. You got to 300%. It has now fallen to about 250%. Now, we've had other instances in the past where the debt levels reached a peak and fallen back a bit. So the 1970s, for example, you had a 1% or 2% fall in level of debt compared to GDP, private debt. Then the 1990s, you had a more substantial fall. I've forgotten the exact numbers. I'll bring them up while we talk. But you had a fall from, say, something of the order of 170% down to about 165%. Now, this time we've gone from 300% to 250%.
In what period of time?
Pardon?
In what period of time?
Over a 2-year time period.
Over a 2-year time period, we've dropped about 50% of GDP in terms of private debt.
Yeah,
that's very fast. Yeah, that's pretty radical. That's pretty dramatic. So are you suggesting that we need to, that we've gone from 300% more or less of debt, three times GDP in terms of private debt, to 2.5 times GDP of private debt, and we won't be out of this depression until we get down to what?
About one times GDP.
About $15 trillion, 100% of GDP.
Yeah, yeah.
And
sorry, $20 trillion. Because the private debt level in America peaked at $42, $43 trillion. It's been paid down a small amount. But what you've got a combination of two factors at once. Even though GDP is not growing, it's growing a bit. So you've had that slight increase in the denominator of the ratio of debt to GDP.
Right.
But at the top level, you have the debt also being reduced in actual terms. So that combination together means your ratio has fallen from about 300% to 250%. I'll give you the exact number.
Right, but it's got to get down to 100% before we're not in a depression anymore. And at the current rate of deleveraging, I mean, if we're dropping 25% a year, and we've got another 150% to go, is that another 5 years?
Something like that. 5 to 10 years. I was just looking at the exact figures now. It peaked at 301% especially February, March of 2009, and fast forward to 2011, it's down to 260%. So you've fallen 40% over 2 years. Now, I think when you get to a debt level of around about the 100% level of GDP, you're out of the woods in terms of not having a massive amount of speculative debt still on the books, and the effect of people reducing their debt by reducing their consumption and investment will be over, but that could take up to 10 years.
So we could be in this depression. Now, is it going to get – we have just a few seconds here before the break is going to hit, but then we'll continue our conversation. Is this going to get worse before it gets better, or is this just going to be awful for a while?
I think it's going to stay at this awful level and get slightly worse because, remember, you need a growing economy to absorb a growing population. And if you have a population when you're growing at 1 or 2% per annum, and you have technological improvements occurring at about a rate of about 1% increase in productivity per annum, you need to grow at 3% simply to keep your unemployment levels steady. If you instead have the impetus that investment gives you taken out of the economy, then you're going to look at being about best 2% rate of growth. So that unemployment rate will slowly creep up, and that's not pleasant for anybody.
So that's actually slowly sliding backwards, actually.
We're
talking with Professor Steve Keen, Associate Professor of Economics and Finance at the University of Western Sydney, the author of Debunking Economics. His website, debtdeflation.com. Check it out. We'll be right back with Professor Keen. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Debt, D-E-B-T, deflation, D-E-F-L-A-T-I-O-N.com is Professor Keen's website. It's brilliant. Check it out. We'll be right back. With defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. We're talking with Professor Steve Keen, Associate Professor of Economics and Finance at the University of Western Sydney, talking with us live from Australia, where it's probably the middle of the night. And he's the author of Debunking Economics, his website, debtdeflation.com. And Professor Keen, just to quickly recap, you're suggesting that the seeds of this second Great Depression were sown in Bretton Woods in 1945 with the U.S. dollar becoming the reserve currency of the world, and that this depression is different from that of the 1930s because this level of private debt that you identified as being 300%, three times GDP, and has now dropped down to 2.5% over the last couple of years, thus producing the depression, that is fundamentally different in character than the level of private debt at the time of the last Great Depression. How is that? And have I characterized accurately the summary here?
Yes, you have. When back in the 1930s, with the level of debt peaking in before deflation began, peaking at 175% of GDP, from that point on, the level of debt reduced. Nominal debt actually fell, but the ratio to GDP rose because of deflation. The reason that
because GDP was collapsing.
GDP collapsed and so did prices. Prices were falling by up to and over 10% per annum, as well as real output falling by much the same level. So you had this if you look at the ratio of debt to GDP, then the denominator just collapsed.
Sure.
And that drove up the ratio, even though the numerator was also falling. Now, that debt was being 175% in total. About 125% was private sector, non-financial businesses, you know, the shops, manufacturers, and so on.
Yeah.
So when they found themselves that the crisis beginning, they had to service their own debt, not the, you know, it was their debt level that was constraining their capacity to spend.
Right.
Well, they had to pay their debt down, and the first response was to try to improve their market share by cutting their prices. But of course, they all cut their prices.
Right.
Therefore, you got prices fell faster than businesses repaid their debt. And Irving Fisher expressed this in what I call Fisher's paradox. He said, "The more the debtors pay, the more they owe."
Right.
Now, that's what gave us a really, really sharp downturn. This time around, even though we've got roughly 1.7 times as much debt at the peak of the crisis, 301% of GDP versus 175, that debt is only about 75% of it at its peak was owed by non-financial businesses. The rest was owed by the household sector and by the finance sector. And the households, rather than having, I think, something, a debt level of something in the order of 25 or 30% of GDP back at the Great Depression, have almost 100% now. So it's not the producers and the retailers who are debt constrained this time around, it's the customers.
And without customers, you have no economy. Is this why you're suggesting that we should consider Leviticus 25:10, consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout the land unto all inhabitants thereof? It shall be a jubilee unto you. You shall return every man unto his own clan, every man to his family. The land, you know, it goes on basically, forgive all debt, free the slaves, equalize everything.
Yep. That's something we have to do, a modern jubilee. We can't do an old-fashioned one, unfortunately, because back then, of course, the advantage was you had a very obvious class of people who were debt slaves and a very obvious class of people who were moneylenders and landlords, and you could easily, you would reduce the power of the moneylenders and the landlords by doing this, but that was politically vital because otherwise you weren't going to have an army and you were certainly going to have a slave revolt. So it was easy to identify who should suffer, and quite often the moneylenders suffered by having a rather severe haircut, starting roughly around the shoulder level.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't happen anymore, nor can we do even a 1930s version, and I don't know enough about the bank holiday period under Roosevelt, but I expect we'll find this happened during the bank holiday.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of debts were reduced at the bank level.
Yes.
In that period, so that, you know, your mortgages were reduced and so on.
Well, plus Roosevelt created a federal agency to take on household debt, you know, to buy household debts out of the banks and give people federally guaranteed loans.
Back then, all that did was affect the incomes of the banks. Now, of course, if you do it now, the trouble is not only did the banks and the non-bank financial sector, whose debt level, by the way, peaked at 120% of GDP versus trivial levels back in the Great Depression, rather than the shadow banking sector being the only ones who suffer, they've sold those products to middle America as, you know, assets to have in one's pension scheme and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So if we actually abolish the debt, we wouldn't just be affecting the banks now. It'd be affecting people who bought products off the banks.
Right, and not just middle America. It's all over the world.
All over the world. I mean, one of the very first places to suffer, of all things, was a council in Norway when this whole damn thing began, because they'd been persuaded to buy some AAA-rated bonds by American banks.
Right, and this little town in Norway went bankrupt because they had bought this stuff from Goldman Sachs or whoever it was.
In good faith.
Yeah.
And this is the thing, we actually trust these people. The essential thing about money is trust.
Right.
Of course, it's been massively abused by the financial sector. But they've scrambled the egg so completely that unscrambling it is really what we're attempting to do here.
So and 1 minute until the break, in that 1 minute, quickly, and we'll continue the conversation after the break, but 1 minute after the break, how do we do that?
Yeah. We have to find a way of rebalancing the system from being fundamentally credit-based money to, in this transition at least, fundamentally fiat-based, while still providing cash for those who've been savers rather than being debtors.
Is that would that be a variation on the Muslim notion that, and what used to be the biblical notion, that you shall not charge interest, you may only charge fees for banking?
No, I don't think so. I'm not particularly. I don't see the problem as charging interest.
Mm.
What I see is the level of principle that's been extended, which the whole word principle implies what's gone wrong, because principle principled It means done in responsible behavior. We've had irresponsible increase of the level of debt outstanding, and we have to find a responsible way of reducing it.
Okay. And we'll talk about how that can be done after the break. We're talking with Professor Steve Keen. He's the Associate Professor of Economics and Finance at the University of Western Sydney, the author of Debunking Economics. His website, debtdeflation.com. I encourage you to check it out. And we will continue in about 5 minutes here with our conversation with Professor Keen. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Are we in a depression? How do we get out of it? What are realistic ways to do it? What are ideal ways to do it? All that right after this.
The best things in life are free.
Okay, I have so many questions about this. It's crazy. We are talking with Professor Steve Keen. I'm sorry I had demoted you to Associate Professor, Professor Keen. Full Professor of Economics and Finance at the University of Western Sydney, the author of the brilliant book Debunking Economics and the website debtdeflation.com, Twitter at Prof. Steve, S-T-E-V-E, Keen, K-E-E-N. And you're still with us?
Yes, indeed.
Okay, great. First of all, you know, we broached the topic of a jubilee, and I want to get back to that in just a minute and how that might be done in a way that's politically not just palatable but even conceivable. But first, we began this conversation 30 minutes ago with you pointing out that the ratio of private debt, not government debt, but private debt to GDP, had been around 175%, up to 175% that provoked the Great Depression, and then it got deleveraged down to 45%, and then it hit 300% in around 2008, and now it's deleveraged down to 250%, but it still has a long way to go. All that, and please at any point correct me if I'm mischaracterizing or misremembering anything you said. All of that said, what role does the stuff that in our political dialogue here in the United States everybody's hysterical about, and we're hearing the European Union is all hysterical about, particularly right now with Italy and Spain, what role does government debt play in all of this, and what role does the trade deficit, the trade debt, play in all of this?
Okay. The government debt fundamentally acts as a – should act – and has in some ways in the past acted as what you might call a homeostatic stabilizer in an air conditioning system. It's like you've got a room that's overheating, which you get regarded as a private sector you know, having a boom, then the government sector effectively chills the room by running a surplus, taking money out of the economy and reducing the temperature. But then when you have in the other direction, when you have a slump by the private sector, so the room's freezing, and the government goes in the opposite direction. And that sort of, that's pretty much what you'll see. The energy output of an air conditioner runs in the reverse direction to the energy level in a room, and a similar sort of analogy can apply to how the government sector debt generally behaves.
So Keynes and FDR were right in saying the private sector is collapsing, so we're going to heat up the public sector. We're going to borrow money and spend it on hiring people to plant trees.
Yeah. Now, the trouble is it's hard for people to get their heads. This sounds irresponsible, certainly if you come from a right-wing perspective. It sounds, you know, the state spending money and being irresponsible, et cetera,
right,
et cetera. The way I look at it is to regard the economy as having two fundamental sources of money. So what maintains economic activity is the turnover of money, but what actually remains to expand is growth in the actual stock of money. And there are two institutions which can generate more money. One is the private sector by lending money to businesses and individuals. The other is the government by running a deficit. And what you have had in this, what's caused this enormous bubble we were in prior to the crash beginning, was the private sector lending enormous amounts of money and funding the private sector. But the private banks lending to the private sector, funding gambling on asset prices, particularly houses, of course, in America.
Mm-hmm.
So that gave you a false boom. But, of course, to fill that false boom, you're also buying large numbers of goods from China to fill those very large, empty, you know, huge empty American houses you were building.
Yeah.
So you ran a trade deficit as well at the same time. Now, those three factors that affect the amount of money in circulation, because the loans you were taking out in America were being converted into renminbi to buy goods from China. So you had a double leakage going on there.
Right.
So, but I prefer to look at the entire globe as one system and drill down. International currency makes it much more complicated, and maybe even my head starts to spin when I start trying to do that on a telephone conversation. But at the basic mechanism is to look at is the relationship between the private sector debt and public sector debt. The growth in both of them changes the amount of money in circulation. Now, if you have a private sector massively deleveraging as we're doing now, that is actually taking money out of circulation. So the amount of money turning over and maintaining economic activity is falling. If the government sector attempts to run a surplus, they would be doing the same thing.
But now, you say when the government sector attempts to run a surplus, another way of saying that would be if the government sector tries to practice austerity, or if it tries
exactly.
to cut back on its spending, because,
yeah.
I mean, you know, we're so far in debt, there's no way we're going to run a surplus. But if we have less debt, if we cut back our debt, if we do what the Republican Party is suggesting, that's going to be contractive, as well as the deleveraging in the private sector is contractive. You add those two things together, and you've got a horrible Great Depression. Am I saying in plain English what you're saying as an economist?
Yes, you are. I need a bit of translation occasionally. Yes, you're right, exactly. And the people have a hard time getting their heads around this because they tend to think in what I call static reasoning. They don't look through time and think in a dynamic sense because they see this crisis. And they also think about it in a household-type analogy when you've got the much more complicated entity than an economy is. And they think, well, if I'm running a deficit, I've got to cut back on my spending, and therefore that they want me to get right my own system is to spend less, and therefore that applies at the national level as well. But what is actually causing the crisis is the level of debt you've got into. And think about it even as a household. There's two ways you can handle that. One is you can spend less. The other is you can work a lot harder.
Right.
Now, if you actually, if I want to appeal to the American sense of enterprise, the best way to get out of trouble is to work harder rather than just simply to spend less.
Right. And the analogy here for work harder
is have more
government spending, even though it's done with debt.
Yeah, well, because if the private sector is cutting the level of spending, then you've got a huge debt burden. And if you actually tell people to save more money, what that really translates as is slow down the rate of circulation of money and slow down the amount of economic activity it supports, while trying to reduce the debt level. Now, of course, what happens is the ratio, if you do that, your economy slows down, your debt level remains the same, your debt burden actually gets worse.
And is this why the UK right now is sliding into a recession?
Yeah, yeah.
Because
it's why Europe actually signed its own suicide note when it signed the Maastricht Treaty, which set this entire thing up in many ways. But, of course, England not being part of that, it shows that austerity, even without something as stupid as the Maastricht Treaty, austerity actually pushes you backwards. And each time you attempt to do it, you end up with a bigger debt problem than you had beforehand.
Why would these people buy into this notion that you can somehow cut yourself to prosperity?
I know. It's because, unfortunately, a totally insane theory of economics, which is superficially plausible but fundamentally insane, has taken over the economics profession.
Are you talking about Milton Friedman?
70s. And that belief system has become part of how we all think, including politicians, about this problem. And it actually obscures the complexity of a complex capitalist market system and leads us to make insane decisions. Again, if I use an analogy people might be aware of, if you know as a driver and you're going around a corner, most of us, if we go too quickly, will slide off the edge of the road because our natural reflex is to turn into the turn we're doing if we start to slide. A professional driver knows you turn the wheel in the opposite direction. Now, that is partly what we're talking about here because it sounds simple to say if you're running a deficit, you're increasing a debt level, you should reduce your spending and pay your debt off.
Right.
But that's a bit like turning your wheel towards the turn as the car's getting out of control. You've actually got to turn in the opposite direction to regain control.
Right. And then eventually, now the United States came out of World War II with a public debt that was 127% of GDP, if my recollection is correct.
That's pretty much accurate. Yep.
And we paid that down to within 10 or 15% of GDP within a decade. without any austerity whatsoever. In fact, we did the exact opposite. Truman and Eisenhower were spending like drunken sailors, building a national highway system, hospitals, schools, bridges, roads, communications infrastructure, you know, on and on and on. And it grew the economy so much that tax revenues increased and we paid down our debt.
Exactly.
Now, why can't politicians, whether it's David Cameron in the UK or Paul Ryan and John Boehner here in the United States, or for that matter, Barack Obama, look at that period of time and say, gee, that worked pretty well. Why don't we try that?
Yeah. Well, partly one of the reasons it wouldn't be as easy to do then as now as it was then is that back then, of course, private debt, which had ballooned out of control in the 1920s, exploded with the deflation of the 30s, and then fallen back down with the government stimulus packages of the late 1930s and the impact of the Second World War, falling back to 45% of GDP. That was low and not causing any particular problems, and it was also rising at the same time, which is rising debt is not a bad thing when that rising debt fundamentally finances investment. So you have the incredible, you know, industrial growth of the American economy in the post-war period as well. So you had a debt not encumbering the system, rising debt playing a legitimate role to some extent in boosting investment, and then a government sector boosting spending and with infrastructure, which gave you a more productive private sector to begin with. This time round, you're counteracting the biggest level of deleveraging in human history. And that deleveraging will mean, even though the government's throwing large amounts of money in, this money being sucked out by the private sector deleveraging more than counteracts it. So again, if you look at the current level of debt, the government debt has risen about 30-35% of GDP since the crisis began. The fall in private debt's been about closer to 45-50%. So even with the government stimulus topping up the system by, you know, 35% of GDP, the private sector's dipped into it by 45% when net negative.
Well, amazing. And you just said the worst deleveraging in human history. I want to get back to that and back to the Jubilee. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're talking with Dr. Steve Keen, professor of economics and finance at the University of Western Sydney, the author of Debunking Economics, his website, DebtDeflation.com.
From the war against disorder.
Welcome back. We're talking with Professor Steve Keynes, professor of economics and finance at the University of Western Sydney, the author of Debunking Economics, a brilliant book. His website, debtdeflation.com. Check it out. Professor Keen, in the 6 minutes we have left here, more or less, let me just throw two things out and let you go at them. You made the comment before the last break that we're seeing the largest or the most rapid, I forget your phrase, you could correct me on this, deleveraging in the history of humankind. That sent chills down my back. You know, it's like, okay, does that mean this is going to be the worst depression in the history of humankind? Is it going to go international? Is it going to be the kind of thing that's going to like lead to World War II like we saw last time? And secondly, we had been talking about Jubilee. I would love to hear your thoughts on how some form of debt forgiveness could be done here in the United States or internationally that is politically viable. So,
okay. I'll go very quickly through the first bit. The reason deleveraging hits the economy is that total demand in a credit-based economy is not just your income, it's income plus change in debt. And that change in debt can be spent on two things, investment or speculation. Unfortunately, the vast majority in the last few decades was spent on speculation. Therefore, because debt can go from rising to falling, it can have a dramatic turnaround in demand. And to take the situation of the American economy in 2008, roughly, your GDP was about $14 trillion. The increase in debt that year was about $4 trillion. So total spending in the economy on both goods and services and flip that house buying of assets was about $18 trillion. Fast forward to 2010, GDP was still roughly $14 trillion, which is the source of incomes. The change in debt was minus $2 trillion. So we went from being an $18 trillion economy to a $12 trillion economy in about 2 years.
Wow.
That's why it's so severe.
Right.
So long as that continues happening, you're going to have a reduction occurring over time in demand and you're going to grow more slowly than your population grows and rising unemployment and so on. So you have to look at, should the debt ever have been extended? And the answer is no. It wasn't so much irresponsibly borrowed, it was irresponsibly lent. You've got to really say that if you look at where the real responsibility lies, it was the banking sector creating debt because it makes money out of itself, for itself out of creating debt, and enticing us into that through rising asset prices, which the debt itself caused. Now, the trouble is they then onsold that debt by securitization throughout the population. So if you reduce the debt, you'd also reduce the income of anybody in a pension scheme.
Right.
You reduce council incomes and so on. So it'd be monumentally damaging to go for an old-fashioned jubilee. A new, what I've called a modern jubilee would involve effectively quantitative easing for the public rather than the banks. An enormous amount of money has been given to the banks. So measures of up to $8 trillion now being spoken about.
Yes.
$8 trillion. Give that money instead to the public through their bank accounts in such a way that if the particular individual has debt, then the money has to be used to reduce their own debt. But if the individual doesn't have debt, and that could be either a company or a person, that person gets the remainder is cash in their accounts. That would then mean that people who are in debt have their debt level reduced, so the deleveraging happens very rapidly, instantly, virtually. But simultaneously, people who don't have debt have cash they can spend out of, which compensates them for the fact that the debt they own no longer has the same income stream coming in through it.
And
it would still be disruptive, and you would still have lots of banks that would be affected by it because bank cash flows would also fall dramatically.
Right.
So it's not easy. It isn't painless. There is no such thing as a painless way out of this crisis. But something like that may ultimately be palatable.
It is something like that. Only the banksters get screwed, basically.
We've got to focus the attention on the banks alone.
But I've raised this before with conservative economists who have said, but that $7 trillion that was given to the banks wasn't a gift, it was a loan, and they've paid it back. And what you're talking about here is debt forgiveness. That's forever.
Yeah. We need a discontinuity. This is what's very hard for people to get their heads around. This problem has been a slow, gradual, continuous increase in the level of debt. Lending money that didn't do anything productive whatsoever, just let us gamble on house prices.
Right.
Then we've got to the stage where that level of debt is so great that, as Michael Hudson puts it, debts that can't be repaid won't be repaid. Mm-hmm. Or you've got to work out how not to repay them. What in fact is happening is people are trying to find a way to continue honoring those debts,
right,
that they want to maintain this continuous process. We need a discontinuity.
Well,
and banks, giving them, the banks won't do it.
And continuing the debt is what's going on right now, is it not? Where the announcement today that five different central banks are going to help bail out the European community.
Yeah, if they give it to the banks themselves, again, it's just continue the same process. They've got to do it in such a way that reduces private debt. But ironically, the economists in charge of those central banks don't believe private debt is even an issue in the economy still, even after the empirical evidence of the last two or three years. So they would be giving it to the banks, or providing those loans to governments, they expect the loans, the governments to repay. All of it is trying to maintain a continuous process when a discontinuity is needed.
So the economists in Europe and the European community are as crazy as the Republican economists here in the United States.
Yeah, they all read out of the same. They all got taught by Paul Samuelson, Milton Friedman, Hal Varian, if they did, and also a guy called Maskelel. And if you have to read the stuff in these textbooks to believe that anybody can be so nutty as to take this stuff seriously, which, again, Debunking Economics 2 goes through that in great detail. But because they all drank from the same Kool-Aid, effectively, they're all preaching the same Jamestown religion. So only when we break the grip of those people on economic theory are we likely to get anything even vaguely sensible being suggested to politicians.
Yeah, and Jim Jones is alive and well all over the world.
Indeed.
It seems. We're just about out of time. I think we have just a couple of seconds. So I want to thank you, Professor Keene, so much for being with us today. It's really an honor to speak with you.
Thank you very much, Tom. I'm delighted, and I'm going to send a copy of the second edition of the book your way as well.
I look forward to it, and in fact, I'll pay for it, and we can do that whole central bank thing.
We'll do it. Just a review copy. The publishers will pay this one, mate.
Okay. Debtdeflation.com is Professor Keene's website, D-E-B-T, deflation, D-E-F-L-A-T-I-O-N.com, just like it sounds. Be sure to check it out. His book, Debunking Economics, it's well worth the read. And thanks so much for being with us. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Show up, participate, tag, you're it, occupy something. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.